VIP Conduit presents Getting to Know You for June 2022. This month, our special guest is Ralph Brewer from Tennessee. To hear his interesting story, let's welcome our host for this evening, Susie B., also from Tennessee.
Welcome tonight to the June edition of Getting to Know You. And tonight my guest is someone I've known for a number of years, and I feel very honored that you've allowed me to interview you. Ralph, welcome.
Thank you, Susie, and I appreciate the opportunity. I'm honored that you would ask me to do this and hope that, whatever people get out of it, I hope they get something out of it.
Well, let's start off with just basic questions. Where were you born?
I was born in a little town in Lyles, named Lyles, Tennessee. It was in Hickman County, Tennessee, about 65 miles southwest of Nashville, straight out into the Piney Woods. I tell people that I came from so far back in the Piney Woods, my breath smelled like turpentine.
Is this where you grew up, or in that area?
Yeah, grew up down there in Hickman County. Hickman County, for those of you who do not know, is one of the poorer counties in the state. I think it has the distinction of having the most dirt roads in the state of Tennessee.
Now, Ralph, do you have brothers and sisters?
I had three brothers, one older and two younger, and the oldest one and the youngest one have passed on, so it's just the two middle boys.
What caused your vision problem, and at what point was it discovered?
Well, I inherited my vision from my maternal grandfather. He and I could exchange glasses. Our vision was so similar. And it was a congenital thing. Had poor eyes since birth. So it was, just in the family.
Now, when you started to school, did you go to public school?
I did. I went to... I started at the Tennessee School for the Blind in the fifth grade, but my earlier years in school were very, very sporadic. I don't really remember much about going to school. I know I did, but I don't remember much about, going to school in my, up until the fifth grade. I remember some about the fourth because I went more then than I did the previous years. But we live way back in the country, and it just wasn't convenient to get to school. No buses ran by where we lived or anything of that nature, so we had to walk wherever we went.
Okay. Was there a teacher that was very important in your life and was responsible for you going to the school for the blind?
Oh yeah, she was my first of many mentors in life. She was my fourth grade, my third and fourth grade teacher. She had the third, fourth, and fifth grades all in one classroom, and she was I just loved her to death. She was one that would, set me close to the board, and she would, after school, she would stay with me and say, "Ralph, this is pretty important here. I really need for you to get this," and that sort of thing. And so after I finished the fourth grade, she went to my parents and told them that my vision was of such nature and magnitude that they needed to consider my going to the school for the blind. And so she's the one that contacted the welfare department down in the county seat of Hickman County was Centerville, is Centerville. And the welfare department contacted the school and sent an individual down there to talk to my mother and father about my going to the school for the blind. So, yeah, she was very, very instrumental, but it didn't stop there.
Okay, tell us.
Well, they came down from the school and talked, and my mother was illiterate. She never went to school, and she couldn't read or write. And my father had a fifth grade education, so. But anyway, education just wasn't a big deal to them. It wasn't something that they, you know, looked for and that sort of thing. What they were interested in, and my daddy was interested in, is making a living. And when she talked to them, the welfare department got in touch with them and with the school, and they sent a representative down and went out into the woods where my dad was cutting cordwood, and it was the superintendent that came down and visited. So they convinced him that I might have some ability, and convinced him that going to the school for the blind may be the best way for me. They gave out a list of clothing that you would need to go to the school. At that time, you know, you had to have a week's worth of clothing, and you had to buy all those things. And my dad looked at the list, and he said, we might as well forget this, because there's no way I can afford to buy a suit and two pair of shoes and underwear and everything that was on the list. Again, Ms. Jones, my teacher, she stepped in and she contacted the welfare department, or not the welfare department, but the Lions Club in Centerville, Tennessee, and they found me an old suitcase and rounded up the clothing I need to go to the school for the blind. So that's she was instrumental in getting that done as well.
Now, when you got to TSB, was that a cultural shock for you?
Very. I'd never seen an inside bathroom. I was 11 years old, and I'd never seen an inside bathroom. So I tell people, jokingly, but almost true, that I stood around and waited and watched the other kids to find out where they went when they had to go. But that's almost true. But it was a cultural shock. I had my first opportunity to see education up close, to see, you know, how educated people, you know, acted and how they did, and what an education would do for an individual. So it was a cultural shock, but a welcome one. Plus the fact that I had three meals a day and a good warm place to sleep at night. So that was another benefit.
Well, when you say you saw education in action, of course, at TS, at public school, when you went to school, you were there for X number of hours and you saw the teacher during that time, and that was it. When you went to TSB, you lived right in the middle of it. I mean, you were in it day and night.
Yeah. And, we had so many mentors. You know, the house parents played such a large role in your development and how to dress and how to behave and, you know, the manners and one of my big, you talk about a culture shock, about the first morning I was there, I'd been drinking coffee since I was, you know, well, my mama used to give me coffee in a baby bottle. And so they asked, came around, here I am 11 years old, and they came around and asked if anybody wanted coffee, and I said, well, I do. And so I immediately did what I'd grown up seeing everybody in my family and everybody around me do. I saucered my coffee out. And that house parent came around and grabbed me by the nape of the neck and said, "We don't do that around here." Of course, I didn't know what I'd done until she explained it to me. But it was a culture shock. But it was a wonderful experience. I love school and I love being there.
I know for a lot of boys, they got involved in wrestling. When did you get involved in wrestling at TSB?
Well, almost immediately in the fifth grade, I was a little fat, chubby kid. And I went out for wrestling. And we really, at that point in time, wrestling was just sort of rolling around that we didn't really, you know, have a hardcore wrestling program until, you know, a couple of years later when a fellow by the name of Mo Harrelson came in and we got serious about it then. But it was probably the thing because when I went to the school, I had my self-esteem and ego was, I could walk under a snake's belly on my tiptoes. I mean, I was so far down there and I didn't have any self-esteem. I was used to going out on the softball field and being the last one to be chosen. And the teacher, Ms. Jones, would have to say, "Okay, Walter, it's your turn to choose." And do I have to take him? Because they knew I was going to be a liability rather than an asset on the softball field. And that's the reason to this very day I hate any cylindrical object moving at me at a rapid rate of speed.
You never set up pins at the bowling alley, right?
Well, I did. I set pins at the bowling alley. And old Mr. Paget and some of the teachers and the house parents and so forth would hire us kids to go over and set up pins. We didn't have automatic pin setters at that time, and so they'd pay us a nickel a game or a dime or something of that nature to set up pins. But so after I learned to wrestle, just to continue that story about not being chosen, after I learned to wrestle a little bit, I went back home and beat the stew out of all those guys that wouldn't choose me.
I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, but we are definitely coming back. This wrestling thing, I think you were in high school, your junior and senior, you really excelled in wrestling then. And weren't you an outstanding wrestler in the state?
I was very fortunate my senior year to win the state championship and was fortunate to be offered a scholarship to Auburn University, which had a wrestling team at that time. Of course, they don't even have, there's only one college or, you know, SEC team now that has a wrestling team, and that's one of the later ones that came in, titled 9 with the women's athletics, sort of drove the minor sports out. But University of Missouri is the only SEC team that still has a wrestling program now. But I was fortunate enough to get to go to Auburn University under what I consider to be the best wrestling coach ever, by the name of Arnold W. Umbach. And incidentally, he wrote the book that Mo Harrelson, and we got down on the mat when Mo came and started studying the book on wrestling and that sort of thing. And it was ironic that I went to school and was coached by they called him Sweet Umbach.
Okay, we're going to back up again. We're going back to high school. You were involved in wrestling and music. Well, tell us about your piano recital.
Well, when I gave the school, I wanted to learn to play the piano, you know, because we'd listen to the Grand Ole Opry and I'd hear, you know, Dale Woods and Moon Mullican and all like that. And I wanted to learn to play the piano. So I signed up to take piano. And I was learning, here I was a big old long gangly guy in the, you know, in the fifth grade. And so I was learning such stout pieces like, you know, Bill Gorgon's Goat and Grandmother's Minuet and Indian Sunrise and, you know, those big, big highfalutin pieces. And so my teacher came to me one day and said, we're going to play on a recital. I said, oh, okay. I didn't know what a recital was. She said, well, we will be playing in the auditorium. I said, okay, that's okay. She didn't tell me there was going to be people in the audience. And so I walked out on the stage and I announced my tune. I went to Grandmother's Minuet by so-and-so, and one of the big old boys in the back said, you know? I sat down and hit three notes and got up and ran off the stage. And the next Monday, I went into my piano teacher and I said, if I stay in piano, do I ever have to play another recital? She said, of course you do. And I said, I'm out of here.
But that wasn't the end of your music involvement. You played in band, right?
I did. I played in band, played trumpet, and I really enjoyed band. And I played from sixth grade on, I played trumpet in the band.
And you sang in the chorus. I don't think you were actually interested in singing, but for many of the guys, that was a chance for them to see their girlfriend after school hours, right? And I'm sure that wasn't yours.
Well, yes, I was in the chorus, but I did a lot of lip syncing and that sort of thing. But the love of my life... we were sweethearts from the sixth grade on, and she later became my wife for 53 years, and she was in chorus and band and all like that, and I wanted to be as close to her as I could be.
And many of us have heard you and your wife and your two daughters singing. We have the CD. Okay, in high school, can you think of anything that really stands out? An event or somewhere you went on a trip. What about the band trip that went north?
Yeah, in 1956, I think it was, I was in the sixth grade. Our band went to, in the spring of that year, the band went to Washington, D.C., and one of the graduates of the School for the Blind was the legislative liaison with the congressional liaison working for the American Foundation for the Blind, and he was instrumental in getting us to come to Washington and set up all the, you know, the arrangements for us to go to the White House and go into the, you know, into the Capitol and the Senate and, you know, eat in the dining room up there and go to the, you know, to Mount Vernon and to, you know, the Washington Monument and, you know, the museums and that sort of thing. So, yeah, he, Hewlin Walker was his name, and he was an attorney that was a graduate of the school. So we went there and we met our senator, who at that time was Albert Gore Sr. And we happened to, he happened to have a little twerp of a son with him that was a little smart aleck. And his son was with him up there, and we got to meet him too. But he was about my size and that sort of thing, but he was too snooty to talk to us visually impaired people.
Okay, after you graduated, you went to Auburn, and what happened?
Well, I went to Auburn my freshman year. After my freshman year, I hated college. That's terrible for an educator to say, but I tried every way in the world to quit. Left school after my freshman year in Auburn, and Linda and I got married. She was working at that time at a developmental center in East Tennessee, Green Valley. And I tried every way in the world. You know, here I was, 19 years old, 20, maybe 19. And tried every way in the world to find a job. I, you know, went to all the furniture companies. East Tennessee is famous for manufacturing furniture. And went to all those places, even came down to Knoxville and applied at the, you know, TVA and just everywhere I could think about trying to get a job. And I was unsuccessful. And this was the first of many. I think, you know, the Lord guides you in the way that, you know, you're supposed to go. So I think that it was the first of many that many times that I was wanting to go one way and I was directed in another. So after I couldn't find a job, I said, well, I might as well go back to school. So I went to East Tennessee State University for my sophomore year. And after my sophomore year, my high school wrestling coach, Mo Harrelson was his name, he got a job as the principal at the Indiana School for the Blind, and he recommended me to come back to the Tennessee School for the Blind as to teach physical education and coach wrestling on a teacher permit. And here I am going back coaching and teaching students that I'd been on the same wrestling team with and had gone to school with. And so I did that in 1964, graduated in 62, and went back in the fall of 64 and started working at the Tennessee School for the Blind.
Okay, now, being a teacher and being a coach on a teacher's permit, that didn't pay much money, and so you had part-time jobs. Could you tell us about maybe a couple of your most interesting part-time jobs?
Oh, I had a lot of them. I started out making $3,200 a year, and of course, I Linda and I had a baby to come along pretty soon. Back in those days, you know, it didn't have, distribution of your salary over a 12-month period. You had to, they paid you for 10 months, $320 a month. So in the summertime, I would have to find various and sundry jobs. And, oh gosh, I worked as a bellhop. I worked as a desk clerk. I worked as a park in the Metro Park system. I worked at Western Auto as a salesman, and I worked at JCPenney's, and I worked what else did I do? Just anything that I could do to make a little money.
Well, one job that I'm thinking of in particular apparently was during the Christmas holidays. Had something to do with wrapping paper.
Yeah. I was working at Western Auto, and of course I was on commission. I was a salesperson, and so this lady came in there, and the Western Auto brand was of tires were called the luxury premium tires. And she wanted to buy her husband a set of Western, you know, these luxury premium tires. But the caveat to it was that these tires these tires had to be gift wrapped. So I proceeded to gift wrap the tires. I mean, I would do anything to get the commission off of selling a set of tires. So, yeah, I wrapped the tires and used up all the gift wrap in the store. That was the first of two different times I thought I was going to get fired by the manager. But anyway, I got those luxury premium tires wrapped up.
You had one job, too, that I like. And again, this is part-time. We'll get back to full-time in a minute. A job at, I think it's before you graduated, and it was at school, and had to do with a golf course, I think.
Yeah, the Lions Club, the Donaldson Lions Club, where the school's located, is they wanted to hold a hole-in-one, you know, benefit to raise money for the kids at the school. And so in order to do that, they had a front lawn down there that needed to be, you know, needed to be flattened out so that they could make a hole-in-one at it. Well, worked out there one summer making that hole-in-one green down there, and dug it out. And there were some there were some tree stumps that needed to be extricated. And so I went over to the maintenance supervisor. I asked him if he had a chain, and they had these Wiggle World War II surplus trucks, you know, these big old
Tammy Lynn joint
trucks that had four-wheel drive on them. I mean, they were monstrosities. And so I asked him, I said, Mr. Bates, do you mind if I take one of those trucks and do you have a log chain? He said, well, said the school doesn't have one, but I have one. And said, I'll be happy to loan you mine, but you just need to be careful with it. Don't break it. I said, oh, I won't break it. So the truck and log chain and I went back over to the stumps, and I hooked that log chain around the stumps and around one of the stumps and hooked it on to the truck and put that truck in four-wheel drive in the granny gear and started, and that chain, it stretched out all the links until the chain wouldn't even, I mean, you could hold it out like a stick. mean, and I took the chain back over, and you know, the old saying about pushing a log chain, I actually pushed the log chain into the shop there. And Mr. Bates, needless to say that he supersaturated the atmosphere with blue flames of blasphemy.
Now, I know when you, the doctor who recommended that you go to school, it was because that you had macular degeneration, and he thought your loss of vision would come a lot earlier, right?
Yeah, that's right. Old country doctor, he made the diagnosis that I had a juvenile macular degeneration, and he put on a statement, the rationale for me going to the school for the blind from a visual standpoint was that I would probably be blind by the time I was 21 years old. I had a degenerative eye condition. So he wrote that statement, and of course, I think my teacher may have had some persuasion over him as to how to write the letter, because it was also a sociological factor with me to get to the school and get out of the poverty-ridden home that I was in, and maybe she recognized that I may have some abilities, and she just were persistent in wanting me to make the best or do the best that I could. So anyway, yeah, that was it. I got into the school because I had according to the doctor, a degenerative eye condition.
But you were very nearsighted and required very thick glasses, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my eyeball, the normal eyeball, is about 24. Mine is 32, I think it is. Extreme myopia. So it was, I wore glasses that were about, you know, a good half inch thick. Of course, being a extreme myope, I wore concave lenses, which were thicker on the edge than they were in the middle. But anyway, yeah, it was, I had poor eyes. There was no question about that.
All right, let's talk about your professional career. After coaching, I think you said you did that 8 years and you were still at TSB. What were some of the other jobs that you did?
Well, after coaching for 8 years, I was pretty well. I've been wrestling since fifth grade and coaching for 8 years and wrestled in college for a year. And even after I stopped, you know, even in East Tennessee, when I went to East Tennessee State, I refereed some up there as a you know, a job to try to make money. But after 8 years, I wanted to do something else. And so the position of preschool counselor came open. And so by that time, it took me 6 years, but I finally, of commuting in the summertime and working and all that, going to school in the summer and working as well, but I finally got my undergraduate degree. So I applied for a job of preschool counselor traveling the state of Tennessee and going into the homes of parents who had children that were blind and telling them, trying to assist them with, you know, mapping out an educational future for the children, what they needed for an education and that sort of thing. And so I took that job for, 3 years, I guess. 3.5, maybe. And they told me, of course, said, well, now you got this job. Said, you know you're going to have to go on and get a master's degree. I said, oh, my God, here I go again, trucking on back to college. Went to George Peabody College, and which is now part of Vanderbilt University. But I went on back to school there and got my master's degree at George Peabody in 1976, I think it was. Yeah, 76. And then after I got that, then I decided that I wanted something else. I wanted to get off the road and quit traveling. I was in all 95 counties in the state of Tennessee, some multiple times, but got off the road and I became the dean of students or director of student living. And I was in charge of everything, you know, after 3:30. I was in charge of the dorms and the clinic and the, you know, the recreation and fit, and then the volunteers and, you know, those types of things. So that I worked in that job for, again, about 3.5 years. And then I was so tired of working at night. All the jobs that I did, the coaching and traveling the state, I was away from home, and, you know, and my hours of work with the director or dean of students or director of student living was, you know, from 2 to 10. And so all this time I had a wife and two kids that were growing up, and dad wasn't there in the evenings and that sort of thing. So I applied. I heard somebody told me that the West Virginia School for the Blind was, they were looking for a principal. A good friend of mine, Burt Boyer, was you know, the principal there, and he moved on to become the superintendent out at in South Dakota. So I applied for the job and get called in for an interview, and they sort of liked what I said, I guess, and hired me as the principal at the West Virginia School for the Blind.
Was that a positive move?
It was very positive. I really, really enjoyed my time. It was a great learning experience for me. I had a fantastic superintendent up there that served as a mentor, and he really, there's a story when I first got on board there. I went there we moved at Christmas time of 79, and I started as a principal there, and in January the 2nd, I guess. And I worked there for 8 years and, 8 months, I guess, or something like that. But when I first got there, I was having my talk with the superintendent about what we were going to do, and he wanted to find out what some of my thinking was and my goals for the school and that sort of thing were. And I shared those with him, some of the things that I really like to try and that sort of thing. And so at the end of the, I could tell, as far as he was concerned, that the, discussion was over, because he started moving things around on his desk and so forth. And I kept sitting there, and he said, is there something else, Ralph? And I said, well, yeah, I'm sort of sitting here waiting for you to tell me how to do all these things. And he said, well, what the hell do you think I hired you for? And that was the greatest thing I believe I've ever heard. That just turned me loose, and we were able to do some fantastic things at the West Virginia School and start a bunch of new programs. I think the kids had some good experiences and hopefully learned a lot. I learned a lot about how to become a superintendent, and so after 8.5 years, why the superintendency at the Tennessee School for the Blind was open, so I applied for that.
Now, Ralph, one thing that you were instrumental in developing when you were at West Virginia, it wasn't anything to do with your curriculum, but it dealt with a camp down in Alabama. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, it was a space camp for the blind. It just so happened that the director of space camp, or not one space camp, it was the Huntsville Space and Rocket Center, was a fellow by the name of Ed Buckby, who ironically was from, he graduated from from the high school there in Romney, West Virginia. Romney, West Virginia was only had 2,250 people. Small little old town. When they had a parade up there, there weren't any spectators. That was how small it was. But anyway, he called up the assistant superintendent by the name of Max Carpenter. He called Max up, and they'd gone to school together. And he called, Ed had a woman to come to space camp down there. And she wanted to go to space camp. Well, it so happened that she was blind. And Ed told her, said, well, said, I'm sorry, but we can't accommodate you because of your disability. And she didn't much like that statement, so she proceeded to contact her senator. And, of course, the Space and Rocket Center down in Huntsville, Alabama, receives a lot of federal money.
Have you one left channel?
He called, and the senator told him, said, you really, really need to accommodate this lady. So he called the only person that Ed Buckby knew and that about knew anything about blindness was his fellow friend that was a superintendent or the assistant superintendent at the at West Virginia School for the Deaf and Blind. And so he talked to him and said, look, said, I need some help. Said, we need to start a space camp. Well, Max Carpenter was the guy's name. So he called me and he said, we need to fly to Huntsville, Alabama. So we did and started working with Ed Buckby, and we were able to start the space camp for the blind. And that has been going on now for, what, 30-something years. And but it was it's international now. It's not just national, it's international. And every summer there's kids from all over the world come into Huntsville for the space camp, blind kids. So I'm really pleased about that. Ed Buckby, just a little bit about Ed. He was the personal secretary to Wernher von Braun. And, of course, Wernher von Braun is the father of rocketry in the United States. So, and after Wernher von Braun died, Ed Buckby received all of his papers and notes and all that stuff. And Ed has written a couple of books about Wernher von Braun. But that's how the space camp got started.
Okay, well, you came back to Tennessee, and as director of the school, you lived on campus, and you had some various and sundry experiences. Any major thing that happened when you came back as director that just one major thing?
Well, let's see. When I came back, they were in the midst of a building program. They'd already, at that time, they were moving from a dormitory setting to a cottage setting, and they'd already, gotten the footprint, and they were going to build the cottages for the students about. And when I first saw the plans, I got a measuring wheel out, and I measured it from the center of the circle of wagons type of configuration they had. And I went over to that area and measured it, and it came out to be exactly a quarter of a mile. And I went crazy with that. I said, no, this is not going to happen. So, or if I have anything to do with it, it's not going to happen. So, and that was a $3 million project at that time. So, I told them if they were going to build what they had planned, just to, renovate what we already had and let's go that way and not even build a new campus. So I finally raised enough cane that they opened up the master plan again and we redid it, and it went, everything moved in closer, and it went from a $3 million project to a $9 million project back in the late 80s and early 90s. So that was a big jump, but that was the first big building that new campus was my first big thing that I did.
Okay, something else that, of course, you were president of the alumni for a number of years, and when you went to West Virginia, I think your going away present from the Alumni Association was, oddly enough, a set of tires. We didn't want you to break down on the way. You did live on campus. Through the alumni, with your guidance, the Friends of TSB was set up. One of the major things that, well, it's purchased many, many things, but one is this incredible playground.
Back in 1997, we had I don't know how much you want me to get into the rationale that I've, the impetus to establish the foundation, but just to make a long story even longer, we had a situation where the Lions Club had donated a lot of property to the school back in the early 40s, in late 30s, 40s, early 40s. They, at that time, the school was located downtown Nashville, and the kids didn't have any place to rip and romp and, you know, get out of town. So they bought a place that had actually a living space on it where the kids could go out into the country and stay overnight and that sort of thing. Well, make a long story short, when we moved out to the current location out in Donelson, at that time it was in the country, so there wasn't any need for us to, and we were on 103 acres of property out there with a big farm and all like that. So the property that they owned fell into, you know, a fallow condition, and so I was sitting in the office one day, and I got a call from the commissioner of general services, who manages all the state properties and that sort of thing, and he told me that they were asked me if we still use the property. I said no. He said, "Well, I got a buyer. Said we're going to sell it." I said, "Well, that's okay, as long as the kids get the use out of it." The money goes to the school, and he said, "No, sir," said, "it's not going to go to the school. It's going to go into general services and the general revenue." I said, "Well, I've got the deed to the property in my safe in here." And he said, "Well," and he proceeded to give me an education on, you know, state-owned facilities and properties and that sort of thing. And so at that point in time, I said, "This will never happen again under my watch, because any monies that are donated to the kids from now on, we will go to, and we'll establish 501c3 foundation to accept those funds, and our board controls those monies." So that's how that came into being. That's sorry to take so long to go into that.
We have, I know there are people who want to ask questions. But before we do that, is there anything else that you would like to add?
Well, the only thing that I would like to say is, again, how much I appreciate just the very idea that people may be interested in what I, you know, my life or what I've been through. But I tell people all the time, the greatest blessing that I've ever had in my life is to have poor eyesight. And that sounds terrible to say that, I guess, but that allowed me the opportunity to get an education, to meet the girl that I would spend the rest of my life with, to have my job, my family, you know, and everything that's good that's ever happened to me in my life has been because of the Tennessee School for the Blind. And so I'm just so very thankful for, you know, all those blessings and that sort of thing. But people ask me what, you know, about you know, my involvement in lionism and why I'm a lion. But I keep thinking back on the fact if it hadn't been for the Lions Club buying me those clothes and sending me off and getting me a bus ticket, I would never have been there. Just so many things that came together to make me have a blessed life, and I'm so thankful for that.
Okay, gang, we actually did do some shortcuts there. However, it's your time to ask questions, and remember when you ask a question, well, if you have your finger on the key, and you hear somebody asking a question, please let go of the key so Ralph can answer it. Otherwise, if you hold on to the key, he's not going to get a chance. I've been assured that we can take time as we need. So, questions?
Boy, what a great interview, Ralph. This is Becky. You're a very modest gentleman with wonderful achievements, and I admire you. But you didn't touch on your music with your family, and I really would love to hear a little bit about that. I've enjoyed it so much listening to it myself. And for those who haven't, I think Susie did just touch on it briefly, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you and your family did musically. And thanks again for a wonderful interview.
Well, when we lived in West Virginia, of course, we always went to a church that had a cappella music. We without
left channel.
No instruments. And so we were very accustomed to singing part harmonies. And so my three girls, my wife and my two daughters, both, all three of them had beautiful voices, And, of course, I don't sing too well myself, but anyway. But the way we got to really singing was when we lived in West Virginia, we would have to drive, you know, about 30 miles to even go, you know, get a variety in shopping. We'd have to go either to Cumberland, Maryland, or, you know, or to a larger town there, Moorefield, West Virginia, or whatever. We'd have to drive. And so to while away the time, we would sing old church songs and the harmony parts. But my oldest daughter is the one that sort of, she kept bugging us about wanting to make an album. And, of course, all of us were resistant doing that. But she finally prevailed upon us, and we went to an amateur recording studio and recorded that album. And I'm so glad we did, so that we got it. Of course, I couldn't, you know, do anything with it now. I can't hold a note anymore. If you notice my voice, I've got an atrophying vocal cord. That's the reason I sound hoarse pretty much all the time.
Ralph, I think you and your family did wonderful, and you included. I think you don't give yourself enough credit. I think your singing was just fine. And I wanted to let you know how much we really enjoyed you since you've came to VIP Conduit. You're just like a magnet. Everybody loves you, and it's so great to have you here, and thanks for being a member.
Well, it's I that should be expressing appreciation that I do, because, of course, I live by myself and have been since my wife died in 2016, and this group has really meant a lot to me from the standpoint of many times being a support group and helping me to while away some lonesome hours. And so I really appreciate Susie making me aware of this group and bringing me aboard, and all the kindness that's been extended toward me over the years. And I really appreciate it.
Ralph, this is Parker. It's interesting to hear you make the very same statement that I've made myself a number of times. The good things in my life happened to me because I lost my eyesight.
Yeah, the Lord knows how to make, you know, he knows how to make lemonades out of lemons. And that's certainly what he did in my life. And he just kept pushing me into the way that I wound up. I don't know how to better state that, because when I wanted to do something else differently, why, he would put up a roadblock somehow or other and kept directing me to go in the direction I went. So anyway, that's about all I can say about that.
I don't know, Ralph. You're far sweeter than a lemon, so you're not lemonade, that's for sure. Whatever you are, you're something really good to know.
Thank you, Luke.
Ralph, of the three people that influenced you, or I mean, I guess your teacher was the first one who influenced to get the ball going to the school for the blind, and your mom and dad who made the decision, did any of those three see what education did for you?
Yes, my My teacher, my fourth grade teacher that referred me to the school, she started, when I became a student there, she started bringing her students to tour the school every year. And I would always be her guide and directed, you know, the tour and show them around the school. And both my parents saw me, they died very young, but both of them saw me as a teacher. They didn't have the opportunity to see me as an administrator, but they did as a teacher. And so I made it a point to tell that teacher many times how much she meant to me and how much I appreciated her advocacy on my part, and my parents, how much they had made the sacrifice to allow me to come to the school. Of course, after I got into the eighth grade, I told you earlier that my father was one of those that was, you know, education just wasn't a big deal in my family. It wasn't an important thing. Making a living was. And after I got into the eighth grade, well, he started wanting me to quit school and, you know, come on, help him make a living. So I just literally have to beg him every year to allow me to go back to school for one more year so that I could. So after I got into the 10th grade and so forth, he didn't bother me much then because he knew that I, you know, what I, how I felt about it. So, but anyway, yeah, they were, I got the opportunity to tell them how much I appreciated their involvement in my life.
Ralph, I find the house an interesting thing. You and Linda bought a house over on Blue Brick, I think is the name of the street, in Donelson. And you lived there until you went to West Virginia. And then, of course, when you came back from West Virginia, you lived in the superintendent's house on campus. But then you started looking for a house when you got ready to retire. How'd that come out?
Well, yeah, we bought the house here in 1975, I guess. Paid a whopping $35,000 for this house. And when we moved to West Virginia in Christmas time of 79, we sold a house for $38,000. And so when I came back as superintendent at the Tennessee school, as you said, we lived on campus in superintendent's residence there for, 15 years, 14 and a half or something. And we started looking for a house because I knew we were going to have to move off campus. And so this house came available again. So we bought it back for the second time. We loved living on the street so much, so had so many good memories, so we just bought the house back again.
Ralph, when you went to university, and like here comes a kid from the school for the blind, he's in the wrestling team, did any of the guys sort of underestimate you in the beginning?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there wasn't any. I found out that wrestling in the state of Tennessee was not like wrestling in, say, like New York. I had a good friend, my best friend at Auburn, was a wrestler out of New York City, and his name was, he was an Italian Stallion, we called him, and he was a good-looking kid, I'm telling you, and the girls were crazy about him. His name was Carmine Chimento, but Carmine showed me that wrestling wasn't the same all over the country. So I saw fairly early on, although, you know, I was undefeated my freshman year in college, but I saw right away that wrestling wasn't going to be my, you know, as far as my one loss was not going to be possible at that level of competition. So, but anyway, I like I said, I just wanted to quit school and get married. That's all I wanted to do, and get a job.
Anyone else who hasn't asked a question have one?
Well, I just want you to know, Ralph, how much I appreciate the contribution that you made to the field of blindness, not just your job and your family, but to the blind as such, because we need people such as you. And thank you for your contribution.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate those kind words.
Ralph, I didn't bring out, you have won a number of awards. And can you tell us about some of them? And particularly, there was one, what was it? Wings of Freedom?
Yeah, the Wings of Freedom Award is given periodically by the American Printing House for the Blind. And it's the highest award given by the printing house. And somebody up there was fooled into giving me that award. It hasn't been given very much. And so I was very honored to get that. I've been named as the Bill English Award. It's named after Bill English from the Wisconsin School for the Blind. But what it is, it's the School for the Blind Administrator of the Year. And I was fortunate enough to win that one year. And I've been named I'm a member of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. That was a big honor for me. And I'm a member of the Lions. I've been elected to the Lions Hall of Fame, and I've been awarded the Ambassador of Goodwill from the Lions International Organization, which is their highest award that they give. And I don't know, Susie. I've been honored more than the biggest honor I guess I've ever received was having the school building at TSB to be named in my honor. And that was probably because that came from, people that knew me the best. So that was the biggest honor, I guess. But I've just been overly blessed and fooled a lot of people, I guess.
And there's the Ralph Brewer Award that's given every year at alumni.
Yeah, a fellow by the name of John Brown down in Chattanooga, some reason or other, he liked me and decided that he wanted to start an award in my honor and my name. And so we do that almost every year. And so it's, like I said, I've just been honored beyond measure. I was voted the Lion of the Decade for the state of Tennessee and stuff like that. These awards are like, being in jail, I guess. If you put up the time, you'll get them, I guess.
Well, Ralph, I just, I want to thank you so much for letting me interview you, and people ask you questions and learn more about you. And it's just an honor to know an honorable person. Thanks again. And thanks everyone for coming and being a part of tonight's Getting to Know You.
This has been a presentation of VIP Conduit.